Oliver Callan on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by It's for Women. Discover female health insurance through It's for Women.
If Sid's screaming seagull gave you anxiety, you have come to the right place this morning. Owen O'Kane is a practicing psychotherapist, former palliative care specialist, and a Sunday Times best-selling author. He's a new book out. It's called Addicted to Anxiety, and it's inspired in lots of ways by his own experience. He grew up in Belfast during the Troubles. He had a terrible time in school as well. But he broke the habit of his anxiety, and he believes in his expertise. We have habits around anxiety. He has the advice that will help break them. And he joins us from the BBC studios in London. Good morning, Owen O'Kane.
Morning, Oliver. How are you doing?
Very well, thanks. How are you today from an anxiety point of view?
I'm good. I'm really good, actually. Busy, but I'm good. I'm laughing, actually. The kids were great beforehand. They should be writing books.
They are, thankfully. Yeah, but you're dead right. You already sound like a calming force yourself. But you believe we're living in an anxiety epidemic, pandemic affecting, is it every age, everybody?
Certainly it was sort of part of the motivation for writing Addicted to Anxiety. I guess I'm seeing more anxiety than I've ever done in my career, to be honest.
Right.
And it's right across the spectrum, you know, from, you know, I hear parents talking about their kids, young teenagers, adults, and interestingly with older people as well. So I do think we are generation anxious at the moment. So when I thought about what my next book would be, I thought, right, I want it to be an anxiety, but I didn't want it to be a kind of fluffy false promise of heal your anxiety in a day or anything like that. I wanted it to be real, and I wanted it to be, I guess, empowering in some ways, because one of the difficult conversations about anxiety is that people often contribute more to their own anxiety than they realise, and right, we rarely have that conversation. So I guess I see people almost get hooked on the process of anxiety, which motivated the title Addicted to Anxiety.
Oh, it's a fascinating idea, but the whole thing is very personal to you, isn't it? Anxiety, you were hardwired into you from the Troubles growing up where you grew up?
Yeah, I think when you do books and you use these platforms and stuff, I think you have to be brave enough to talk about your own story.
Yeah.
And I didn't realise actually that I was anxious until I left for London. You know, I grew up in Belfast during the Troubles, as you mentioned. And during that period, you know, you were primarily hardwired for anxiety. Most people were growing up during that period. And that actually was a good thing. Anxiety can be a really healthy mechanism. And during that period, to not be anxious would have been problematic, because you needed to be on watch and you needed to be on guard. But I guess the problem with it is then when you leave and you've carried the anxiety with you and you realise that you're in this kind of almost hypervigilant state a lot of the time when you don't need to be, that's when you realise it's problematic. So, I mean, unapologetically, I often talk about that and I use it in my work, because I think, you know, at the end of the day, Oliver, we're all human beings. Mm-hmm. And these conversations are about our humanity rather than a diagnosis.
At home for you was the Ardoyne in Belfast. So that was, unfortunately, a busy place from a news point of view during the Troubles.
Yeah. Well, it certainly, I mean, look, it was no playground, let's put it like that, I guess. Yeah. Just even the position of it was right in the heart of a lot of the conflict. So I guess for me and for everyone during that period, I mean, it was just normal to be in a state of threat all of the time. And I mean, it was during that period.
And
it was kind of regular bombs.
Losing relatives
And, you know, my mum lost her brother during the Troubles. And you know, most people who grew up there lost someone. You know, that was everyday life. And the bombs and bullets and the not knowing what was coming next was part of life, which is an interesting thing for me, really, because the definition of anxiety is an intolerance of uncertainty. So I guess the one thing during that period that people had in abundance was they had a lot of uncertainty. They never knew what was going to happen next. So, you know, it all fits together. You understand very well why people during that period were anxious.
You were caught up in a bomb blast at one point as a child?
Yeah, I mean, again, this was commonplace. My younger brother and I were in town one day shopping and an explosion went off, and it was in a department store, and we ended up, I mean, luckily we were fine, but we ended up covered head to toe in glass. And we were laughing about this a few weeks ago, actually.
Really?
We dusted off after it. You know, I mean, when you think of how, you know, abnormal it was, we just kind of were recovered literally from head to toe, shards of glass everywhere. And I can remember we dusted each other off and then we went, got chocolate and got the bus home.
Oh my God.
You know, so that's the sort of reality that was there.
Like that stoic kind of Ulster sense where everyone just normal day to day.
Well, that's the thing about it. I mean, everyone's talking about anxiety these days, but anxiety wasn't part of the conversation back then. I wouldn't even have known what that meant. And nobody was talking about being anxious. It was just about survival and getting on with it. So it's interesting now that we've now got these very open, honest conversations about anxiety and a realisation actually how problematic it is for a lot of people.
Yeah. So that's one thing you're carrying. And then you have another challenge as well in your life.
I mean, there are a few, Oliver. How long have you got? I guess part of the thing as well is, I mean, I talk about this quite openly as well, as I mean, I grew up gay. Well, I wasn't gay as a kid. Obviously, I hadn't come out or anything. But there was a lot of bullying growing up. And I kind of think for anyone in that kind of, in that area of kind of Irish Catholic Ireland where things were a lot stricter and things were, you know, were different at that time. That was a challenge as well, growing up in that culture where right and wrong and good and bad were defined in a very, very clear way. And difference wasn't tolerated, you know, very, very well back in those days. So I think that just kind of added another kind of flavour to the sense of threat and anxiety growing up.
What form did the bullying against you take?
I mean, it was interesting. It was almost a Billy Elliot type story because I was a little kid playing piano and a couple of my mates and stuff, they were doing dancing and art and stuff. It's really funny how kids find each other.
Yeah.
You know, the kids find their tribe. So the kids who were a bit different were the kids who were being targeted. And I kind of guess because they were, you know, kids are the best psychologists, aren't they? They spot difference. They know when someone's different and they spot it different. So I think there were a group of us who got a pretty tough time during our kind of formative years.
It was pretty bad.
I mean, look, it was, you know, I try, when I think back of, you know, growing up, I try never to think about it as a kind of victim story or a terrible thing, because I think a lot of people experience adversity in their life. Yeah, I mean, I had difficulties and I had challenges, but, you know, I hold the viewpoint that you can make decisions what you do with that, and you can decide either to be defined by it and victimised by it, or you can decide, actually, I'm going to let this kind of inform who I am and how do I grow, how do I develop, and actually how do I use my struggle to kind of do my work and actually hopefully make things a bit easier for people, you know, in day-to-day practice.
And there are kind of, it's funny now, I presume you look back as you do in the book, your mother, despite herself, was the first person to out you inadvertently, I presume.
Yeah, my mum's not around anymore, but I mean, yeah, that was quite an interesting period when kind of having to come out to Irish Catholic parents back in the 90s, you know, because it was just unheard of and stuff. And I remember when I came out to my mum, there was this kind of long silence. And then she said, I thought all the gays lived in New York.
They just magically popped up there.
So I thought, well, actually, no, they're a little closer to home than that. But, you know, back then, that was the sort of attitude. There was just there wasn't awareness of it. But, you know, it's incredible, actually, how parents adjust and how they come to terms with stuff and how people get to understand. You know, I think that's, I often say, you know, around the whole coming out story, you know, there's an expectation sometimes that we expect people to come to terms with stuff very, very quickly. But often it takes us a long time ourselves to come to terms with it.
Yeah.
So it's often not realistic to expect those in our lives to understand it quickly. Sometimes it's a bit of patience about helping them, you know, understand things a bit better. And I learned that, you, I guess, Oliver, it's one of the things about getting older, you become a bit wiser.
Yes, for sure.
And when you look back on things, you see them differently. And I can see that very differently now.
And what did your mum tell the neighbour?
Well, no, one of our neighbours asked at the time when my mum had mentioned me coming out, one of the neighbours asked, did I dress up in women's clothes?
Oh, God.
So that went off in a completely different direction. So, you know, and again, it's just that level of information and sort of some of the ignorance around sexuality at the time. And so my mum, I remember her telling me this story, and she says, well, not that I know of. She said, have you got anything else to tell me? And I said, no, we're good there. But actually, on the night I came out to my parents, it was this hilarious story. My mum went through this. I'd said to them, listen, I've got some news for you. Something I want to talk to you about. And my mum went through this list of possibilities. So have you got someone pregnant? The big one in Northern Ireland at the time, are you going out with a Protestant? And so she went through all of this list. Are you taking drugs? Are you doing this and you're doing that? And the very last thing she then said was, are you gay? So it came as the last question, but it was interesting, the list of possibilities that went before it.
Right.
But actually, I think, you know, back in those days, if I had said I was going out with a Protestant, I think that would have been a bigger drama at the time, to be honest.
It's a harder coming out.
So I think it was probably a bit of a relief. That's the world we lived in.
Yeah. You're typically Belfast stoic about all of your problems, but I presume all of this stress did manifest itself in your adulthood when you move on and into a career and so on.
Well, here's the thing, you know, it's when I moved to London, actually, I suddenly realised that I sort of realised, and this was part of the motivation for the book, Addicted to Anxiety. Mm. I realised that there was part of me primarily hardwired to keep an eye out for danger and for threat. And I, when I kind of moved away, I realised that my level of threat was higher than most other people I knew. That things that didn't bother them or things that weren't concerning them as much were bothering me. And I guess, you know, as therapists, we have to be in our own therapy. And I guess in my own therapy, that I did discover that there was part of me probably had more anxiety than I needed. And that's the key thing for most people. You know, if you're primarily hardwired for threat or if you've grown up with anxiety, mm-hmm. most people of adults never think of going back and updating the script, because very often the anxiety that existed when we were younger isn't required anymore. So very often it's about going back and kind of recognising that and updating the nervous system, actually, that there's no current threat, there's no current danger. You're not in that same situation anymore. So very often, you know, anxiety and trauma often very, you know, they often come hand in hand. And that very often includes, yeah, and it often includes childhood trauma. You know, so I've never met anyone who'd has had any degree of childhood trauma, whatever that is, who doesn't have some degree of anxiety. And if you don't deal with the anxiety and you don't go back and update, then, of course, anxiety is going to come with you. And, you know, and this is the thing that's really important about anxiety. I never at any point in this book talk about getting rid of anxiety. You never want to get rid of it. Yeah. You never want to push it away. Anxiety is a really helpful mechanism. You know, we need to have anxiety. It's a useful thing. The problem for most people is, and I think what we see in everyday life at the moment is that most people's anxiety is ramped up way higher than it needs to be.
Right.
And the problem with that is most people don't know what to do about it. And that there within is a challenge. And they also don't realise that they are a part of the maintenance of anxiety. And that's a conversation that we're not having enough. People like to have conversations about anxiety as something happening to you. Mm-hmm. And that's true to your point. But actually, every person I sit down with that I'm working with in therapy, when I speak to them about their anxiety, what I discover is that they're doing a lot of things that actually maintain their anxiety.
And this is the key component, isn't it? You think we're hooked on it. Why would someone get addicted to something that's so negative and they know it's negative as anxiety is?
It's a brilliant question. So if you think of any addiction, so if you think of someone who's addicted to drunk or to drugs, to drink or to whatever, there's a double-edged sword. So at one level, they will get benefit from the addiction in terms of escapism, ease and pain, not feeling for a while. But every addict I've ever met will always talk about the darker side of the addiction. Mm-hmm. Now, with anxiety comes with a huge promise. It promises to keep you safe, to protect you, even though it feels terribly uncomfortable. So when you're working with people who are anxious, they often describe hating the feeling of anxiety. They don't want to feel anxious. But then when you try to move them through the anxiety and move them beyond it, they resist it because they... Let me give you an example. This is probably the best way I can describe it. Yeah. I had a client a few weeks ago and I've been working with her now for a couple of months, and she came into therapy and she said, "I'm feeling brilliant. I'm feeling really, really good." And she said, "You know, for the first time in 4 years, I sat on the edge of my bed the other day when I woke up and I didn't have those knots in my stomach." Mm-hmm. And I said, "Well, that's brilliant. God, it's really great to see you kind of breaking through." And then she went quiet. And then she said, "I'm a bit worried." And I said, "What are you worried about?" She said, "I'm worried what happens without the anxiety."
Oh, Christ. Okay.
So, because what happens if things go wrong? What happens if I miss something? And I think, even though that might sound a bit extreme, what happens, and this is the addictive component of it, I think people become addicted to anxious thoughts and, you know, the what if, the catastrophizing, the worrying, the predicting. People engage with those thoughts as if they're a fact and they get very, very tied up in the spiral.
So you kind of
thinking,
it could be a small thing and you turn it into a huge thing because you're always just looking for something to be anxious about.
Yeah. And you over-engage with the thought. And of course, the more you do that, the anxious brain will feed off that and then produce more and more content. So that's kind of just one of the components where people, they get attached and they get hooked to habits of thinking where they're almost kind of habitually looking for the problem or imagining the worst is going to happen. And the same thing happens with the emotions as well. As most people who describe anxiety, will also talk about not liking the feeling, you know, the fear, the dread, the uncertainty that comes with it. But most people try to push the feeling down. They don't want to feel it. But the problem with that is, you know, emotions have a beginning, middle and end. They need a, you know, they need to flow through. Mm-hmm. And if people are pushing the emotion down or trying to get rid of it or repress it in any way, the problem is it accumulates, which is why people often describe feeling uptight, feeling like they're overwhelmed, like they're not coping, because all of this emotion has been held back. So it's a really complicated process in the sense that people don't want it, but at the same time, they do a lot of stuff that means that they don't let it go.
There are interesting things you have, such as being hooked on anxiety because it's comforting in ways. It makes decisions for you. Explain that for us.
Well, I mean, it's like, say, for example, you had something big on today, Oliver, that you were nervous about. Say you had a big presentation or a gig to do and you felt nervous about it. Your anxious brain might jump in and say, Oliver, don't do it.
Yes.
It's too risky. You might get rejected. You might get criticised. It would be easier not to do it. So your anxious brain might convince you not to do it because that would be a safer option. And if you listen to that, then you might pull out of the gig and not go and do it. Now, the problem is people who do that, then shorter term, they feel better. But the problem is longer term, the anxiety gets maintained.
They start to wonder what would have happened if they just gone ahead. So they lose opportunities as well.
Well, they lose opportunities, but actually what they do is they reinforce the mechanism of anxiety, because if they have felt short term, okay, I got relief and I felt better by not going, you know, so I didn't go to that job interview, I didn't do that talk, I didn't go to that social event, whatever the context might be, people get short term relief out of the avoidance.
Yeah.
But the problem is longer term, that then feeds the mechanism. So the anxiety doesn't back off. It just keeps coming back. So inadvertently, one of the kind of challenging things about anxiety, and for anyone listening today, this is going to feel completely counterintuitive, but everything that you're doing to manage your anxiety, whether that's kind of avoidance, whether it's pushing it away, mm-hmm. whether it's doing things to try and soothe it and get rid of it, these are all of the things that will feel right and they will feel intuitively right. But the problem is they're counterintuitive, because most behaviours around anxiety are actually going to keep it going longer. So you're actually bringing people in a really different direction to try and get them unattached from these patterns. And then they start finding their breakthroughs. And the good news in all of it is that, you know, anxiety is really treatable. And my experience, you know, if people have a negative relationship with their anxiety and they don't like it and they see it as a toxic, awful thing in their life, well, then that's what it becomes. So when I'm treating someone, my first line of kind of attack really is to help people build a more positive relationship with their anxiety so that it doesn't become the enemy.
Right.
That
now,
they start to understand.
Before
you
come to your tips, I want to kind of put to you, how will you know if your anxiety is kind of the part and parcel part of your life, the normal anxiety, versus if you have the bad anxiety that you need treated?
Yeah, it's a good point. So, you know, look, functional worry is a part of our everyday life, and functional thoughts are part of our everyday life. So, you know, if someone today is... they've got a hospital appointment they're going to, they may be worried about going to that hospital appointment. We wouldn't say that's an abnormal worry. Or, you know, if one of their kids was sick or whatever the context might be, that's functional, normal worry. When we start to think about anxious worries that become more problematic, that's when, you know, worry tends to become very ramped up. It becomes almost at the point of focus. And that can play out in many ways. It can be multiple worries. It can be worry about a specific thing like health or socializing, or it could fall into the parameters of something like OCD. But my bottom line is, if anxiety is starting to get in the way of your life, if it's starting to impact how you relate to people, if it's starting to impact in your job, if it's starting to impact in your social life, and the bad days are beginning to outnumber the good days, then that's a really good time to either pick up a book like this or talk to someone or get help, because that means actually anxiety is in the driving seat of your life. You're not in the driving seat anymore.
Right.
That's when you need to start looking at it.
And this is where you come to the practical techniques in the book.
Yeah. And you look, here's the thing, Oliver, I think this is a really important point. I could talk to you about hundreds of techniques today.
Right.
And in my experience, if people hold a negative belief about their anxious self, you know, and I often refer to it in the book as the anxious self, it's that part of you that's scared. If you hold a negative relationship with that part of you, then what you end up doing is you end up repressing that part of self, and you end up abandoning, you know, you abandon that self in some way. So no technique in the world is going to have a lasting difference if you keep rejecting that part of yourself. So the, one of the biggest breakthroughs is when people say, okay, this is a part of me. It's a normal part of me. It's a part of me that I'm not going to reject. I'm going to try and understand it more. I'm going to try and work with it. And I'm going to try and learn to negotiate with it. I think when people learn that skill, they're halfway there. Then all of the other techniques then become much more effective. So, you know, for anyone listening who has an awful relationship with their anxiety, I promise you wholeheartedly, just this one tweak where you start to look at it differently and think, okay, well, this is just a helpful part of me that means well. Mm-hmm. It tries to protect me, but sometimes it's just working way, way too hard. And my job is to re-educate it and start to work with it in a different way. I think above everything, that is my number one tip.
Right.
That shift for most people can be monumental. And I've seen people in treatment for years and they've done everything. They've meditated, they've done mindfulness, they're in cold water, they've climbed mountains, they've done everything. But when you speak to them about how they feel about their anxiety, they immediately tear themselves apart and they tear the anxiety apart. And there, for me, is something really, really important, you know, create a new relationship with it to start.
Very good. I'm going to put some questions to you, Owen O'Kane, because they're coming in on the text 51551. Someone says, I'm not sure if it's anxiety or depression, but most mornings I wake up feeling consumed by worry. Mind seems to search out every possible problem. When up and about, things are reasonably okay. I suppose when they're up first thing in the morning, they're consumed by worry.
That's a really common thing, Oliver. So in the morning time, our cortisol levels are higher. And that means we can worry more. There's always a lot of chemical stuff going on in the body. And what I'd say is, you know, people ask that question all the time. What's the difference between anxiety and depression? I kind of think a really straightforward way to answer that is to think about speed. So people who are anxious often have a lot of hyperactivity going on in their body, a lot of activity going on in their mind. They often feel quite wired. They often feel quite uptight a lot of the time. Mm-hmm. And from that question and that description, if there's an overload of worry and a lot of overthinking, then that's probably more likely going into the parameters of anxiety.
Yeah.
Now, what you can get is you can get secondary depression. I sometimes see people who are so exhausted with worry that sometimes there's part of the brain called the dorsal brain, and sometimes it will kick in and almost, you know, force the person to go into a state of collapse just to allow the brain time to rest. And that can be more a secondary depression that can come with it. The other side of the coin is if someone is depressed, it's normally a different feeling. It's normally a lot more exhaustion, a lot more demotivation, a sense of gloom. The speed, the activity of thoughts can be much more sluggish and slow. So it has a different flavour to it.
Yeah, it's interesting. There's another person that I've experienced anxiety since my teens. When I had my first panic attack at uni, I noticed a significant increase in anxiety during the perimenopause. I wish there was more awareness of this huge hormonal impact on so many women. Trying to cope with work, kids and life, when anxiety makes it hard to leave the house is tough.
It's a really massive issue. In fact, I was speaking to Davina McCall last week on her podcast. Yeah. Davina's done a lot of work around menopause and stuff, and that was one of the conversations we were having around menopause. Now, here's a really interesting thing. This happens for women, but I also think we need to have more conversations about men and hormonal changes that come later in life. I know and I see a lot of men who have hormonal changes, and of course, we don't have this conversation because it's just seen as a bit woke. But men have hormonal changes as well, and it's often misdiagnosed as depression, you know, because they get there's a lack of testosterone and there are changes in hormones. So it's not just a female conversation. I think there's a conversation with men here as well. But it does massive contributory factor to anxiety. And, you know, that's the thing. Anxiety is never a single component. It's not just always about hormones. It can be about background. It can be about trauma. It can be about the external stressors. And in my experience, you know, anxiety often is a family affair. Mm-hmm, you know, yes. if a child is anxious, then often the parents are anxious because they're worried about the child.
Someone's so actually said anxiety has ruined my entire life. Was born in rural Mayo in 1950, inherited it from their mother, they believe.
Yeah, I mean, and this is not judgments on parents in any way, shape or form. I do think it's a family affair. And I was having a conversation last week, you know, parents, you know, we have a lot of anxious children at the moment. And, you know, it comes up in every talk, every conversation I do about anxious children. And I think very often parents mean well. They want to support the child and they want to reassure it as much as possible. And if the child says they don't want to do something, then they kind of say, OK, well, you don't have to do it. And very often, you know, when you're supporting a child with anxiety, what you're trying to do is you're trying to help the child self-nurture and self-soothe and gain confidence that they can cope, because over-reassuring the child can make them more anxious, even though that's going to feel counterintuitive for the parent. Wow. And also for the child who the parent said, OK, you don't need to go, you don't need to do it. Sometimes a more powerful thing would be, OK, let's see if we can do it. I'm going to come with you. Let's think about how good you'll feel afterwards. Now, obviously, you never want to overwhelm the child. But in psychology, we talk about safety behaviours. And children will often come up with a lot of safety behaviours that actually, the goal is to try and not feel anxious. But in some ways, what you're trying to teach the child is that you can feel anxious and you can cope with it and you will manage it. So I think this is one of the things I get most passionate about is a lot of stuff that you see online talks about getting rid of anxiety, when actually it's never ever about getting rid of anxiety. It's about recognizing it and, really more importantly, learning how to navigate it and learning how to work with it in your life. That for me is way more powerful.
And there are tips in here. Of course, if you have anxiety, you're probably thinking, well, a self-help book is not going to help me because I'm too anxious to sit down and follow through some of the breathing exercises and the tapping once you've calmed your mind.
I would disagree. Because I think, I mean, I don't want to sound self-congratulatory here with this book, but when I wrote in Addicted to Anxiety, my premise when I sat down to write this book was that it was a book that I wish someone had given me in my 20s, when I didn't understand what was happening for me. So what I've done in this book is I've broken it down really carefully so that someone doesn't get overwhelmed. And I break it down bit by bit, you know, understanding what's happening for you, why you've got hooked, your role in it. And, you know, there's never a judgment or a shaming in that in any way, shape or form. And then what I do is I break it all down. I break down the thoughts and the mind. I break down the emotions, what's happening in the body. Now, here's a point, Oliver, I should have mentioned earlier. The chemicals that we secrete in the body when we're anxious are the same chemicals that we secrete when we're excited.
Okay. Can't win.
So it's a really interesting thing is that, you know, if you think about it, if you're really excited, you've got no problem with those feelings that go on in your body because you're associating it with excitement.
Yeah.
When we're fearful and when we're anxious, we've got the exact same mechanism going on in the body. Mm-hmm. But actually, the only difference is our interpretation and our over-engagement with the mind about what might be happening. So, you know, the power in all of this here is, you know, for anyone listening today who might be feeling anxious or overwhelmed or feeling that there isn't hope, you know, I promise you wholeheartedly, and I say this as a human being who's lived through anxiety, there is a way through. There are so, so many things that you can do that will help. And, you know, because it feels awful today or you feel overwhelmed or it feels like anxiety is in charge, that isn't the case. The more you can learn to step back and get to understand this more, and learn to work with your anxiety as a really good force in your life that you just need to learn to work with in a very different way. Breakthroughs really do begin to happen. I see them every day in my career, which is why I do this work. So for anyone who is feeling a bit hopeless, I promise you wholeheartedly, you know, there is something in this book for everyone. But if you are feeling up against it or you feel like you're not coping, this is a temporary state. Things can improve, they do improve. So I'd really encourage people to pick this up and read it.
Well, it is encouraging. It's about we have the choice and to seize the choice. And I'm sure compliments will always help with someone in anxiety. Owen, there's some in for you. Big hug to Owen. I remember him fondly when we were both novices. He was and is a beautiful person, says Ruth Hart.
Ruth. Yeah. Well, there's an interesting story there. In my early 20s.
Well, unfortunately. We did the important stuff.
And that's for another day.
Yes, exactly. And there's a lovely compliment from Andersontown as well during the Troubles, saying that they live their life in a permanent state of anxiety. It's true. They can recognise themselves. Many of the things that you spoke about, Owen, and they're going to buy you the book. That's Noel from Andersontown up north as well. Owen O'Kane, the book is called Addicted to Anxiety, How to Break the Habit. And hopefully people can do just that. But it's been a pleasure, Owen. Thanks so much.
Thanks so much, Oliver, for
Take
having
care.
Me.